Chapter 26. On Board the Schooner Kai Douglas Starlight, June 1872. Thomas was leaning against the railing amidships when the whale breached, flinging half of its 60-foot body completely out of the water and splashing down just a few yards from the stern of the gaff-rigged schooner. Its knobby head and white-tipped fins gleamed in the twilight before disappearing below the surface and then exploding out of the water a second time a moment later. "It's dying," a voice said. Thomas turned to see that Timothy Boswell had come up beside him. The English botanist had a pipe in his mouth and a bottle of brandy and two glasses in his hands. He handed a full glass to Thomas and braced himself against the rail to counter the light swell. "What do you mean?" Thomas asked. "A creature who can do that should live forever."
"It should be in the Bering Sea by this time of year," said Boswell. "They mate and calve here in the South Pacific, then migrate thousands of miles to the north to their ancient feeding grounds."
He tapped his pipe against the rail.
"This one didn't make the journey, which means it couldn't. We don't know all that much about any of the order cetacea, the whales, but I promise you, there isn't another humpback within 1,000 miles of this poor fellow. He will not see their return this winter."
Thomas watched the great fan tail of the whale slap the water 2 times, and then its massive form slipped into the depths. He stood quietly for a moment, listening to the snapping of the canvas sails and the rush of water breaking around the bow. They were 6 days into the 17-day voyage from Honolulu to Tahiti, and every minute of every day had been a learning experience. The 96-foot, 2-masted Kai Douglas carried a captain, a cook, 3 crew members, and 250 tons of cargo in its hold, as well as 3 paying passengers, Thomas, Boswell, and an American-educated Tahitian missionary named Edward Kahale. Their destination was Matavai Bay on the island of Tahiti, the largest of the Polynesian Windward Islands. The day after the fight with Fitch Donegan at the Pearl, Akoni introduced him to Captain Winston McNabb, who he sailed with when collecting specimens for the British Museum.
"You've got to leave the island for a couple of months,"
Akoni told him as they made their way from the Pearl to the home of the fisherman Henry Kaka'ako.
"It looks like Donegan has purchased the Pearl. He isn't going anywhere, at least not until he settles the business with you. You can't return to the mainland, and you cannot remain here."
"So I just keep running and waiting for that bastard to show up one night and shove a knife in my back?" asked Thomas.
"I won't do that."
"No, you will let me work through my uncle's contacts in California to see what pressure we can bring to bear on Stafford. He is a much bigger problem than Donegan. We will find a way to persuade him to call Donegan off."
He hated to admit it, but Akoni was right. The cat and mouse game with Donegan would go on for a long time. One way or another, Stafford was the key to resolving this business and letting Thomas get on with his life. He and Akoni met with Tayana that night and learned that Princess Noalani had arranged a domestic position for her with missionary Grimthrup and his family. She would be fine until he returned. Then they met McNabb at the Palace Hotel and arranged for Thomas to board the Kai Douglas when it sailed in 3 days. That gave him time to collect the 4 months of army pension that the office of the American consul had finally been authorized to pay, to purchase clothing and supplies, and to borrow 2 books about Tahiti from the king's principal secretary. He desperately wanted to see Noelani, but caution got the better of him, and he spent most of his time waiting at Kaka'ako's house. He would come face to face with Donegan soon enough. Captain McNabb stepped out of the gathering darkness and joined Thomas and Boswell on the railing.
"This a private conversation?" he asked.
Boswell lifted the bottle of brandy.
"Not if you brought your own glass," he said.
McNabb held out a tin cup for the botanist to fill.
Bembe's got the helm and we're making 6 knots under a following wind, he said. The sky is clear. We've got a whale leading the way, and in 3 or 4 days, we'll cross the equator. We'll pick up the southeasterly trade winds around 5 degrees south of the line, and from there to Nuka Hiva and on to Tahiti will be a downwind sail. He lifted his cup. Here's to a sweet passage, boyos.
Thomas liked the scrappy, Maine-bred sailing master. He was a born storyteller who put the lie to the notion that New Englanders were a thin-skinned, taciturn lot. On their first morning at sea, McNabb took Thomas and Edward Kahale aside and presented them with a choice. 17 days at sea will seem like an eternity if you choose to do nothing more than eat, sleep, and wander the deck. You're paying for your passage, and you can do nothing if you wish. Mr. Boswell will be sketching and cataloguing what he hauls in with his dredge net, and more the better for him. But if you'd like to make your days pass quickly, we can help with that. We can introduce you to the noble art of rigging, and teach you how to tie knots, work with a needle, and manage the canvas. Might even have a lesson or two in practical navigation. You won't qualify for a first mate's rating before we make landfall, but you'll pick up a few things that will stand you in good stead for the rest of your lives. And boys, he continued, even though the cyclone season has mostly passed in the southern hemisphere by June, truth is we could still hit a squall. And I wouldn't mind if you knew how to lend a hand if a blow hits. McNabb's proposition presented an easy choice for Thomas and the young missionary, and by that first afternoon they were seated on the deck for a lesson in knot-tying with Heron, one of the Kai's 4 crewmen. Heron began his lesson with a description of his crewmates. Now, Bembe is a yar shipmate to have on your back when a cyclone drops, said the thin, bearded sailor as he laid a dozen short lengths of manila rope on the deck. Jamaican fella. Superstitious about everything and everybody, and the best sail rigger I ever met. Next to my own self, of course. A gaff rig only needs 1 man per mast, you see. And ye've met Willie, our ship's boy, 14 and sharp as a sea wolf's saber. McNabb's the perfect master for a boy like him. There ain't no buggering allowed on his watch. That's the saint's truth. I seen far too much of that in my 15 years in the Navy. Captains believe the proper port for a storm brewing in a man's trousers is under the petticoats of a proper bit of jam. No, sir. A boy's backside is safe on the Kai Douglas. Thomas shook his head with a bemused smile and looked over at Kahale to see if the missionary was blushing. But Heron's remarks seemed to have blown over his head. The old sailor handed them each 2 lengths of manila rope and lit his pipe, signaling it was time for the lesson to begin. "And what about the ship's cook?" asked Kahale, as 2 chickens raced past them on the deck, followed by the captain's dog in hot pursuit. Heron reached out 1 hand and grabbed the mutt before it could take out one of the ship's fresh egg suppliers.
"Jacob! I forgot to mention him. Fine cook, minds his stores and keeps the galley spotless. Serves up the tastiest bag of mystery I ever ate, too."
"Bag of what?" Thomas began.
"Mystery, my boy, mystery. Also known as sausages. Nobody knows what the hell they pack in them guts they use for them torpedoes," he said with a wink. "And that's probably a good thing, don't you think?"
The sailor picked up a coil of manila line from the deck.
"Now, this here's called rope, lads," Heron began.
Kahale chuckled.
"Perhaps we can bypass the obvious and get to the knots."
Heron scowled.
"Obvious? To understand knots and hitches, you need to understand rope."
He held a length of rope up high.
"There are 3 strands in this line, and they are right laid, which means they spiral round the rope in a clockwise fashion. Each strand is made of 7 individual threads that are left laid, meaning they go counterclockwise. That there, the clockwise and counterclockwise construction, is why rope holds its form and does not unlay. Now watch."
Heron quickly tied a knot in his rope and dipped it into a bucket of seawater that Willie was using to wash the deck.
Rope gets stronger when it gets wet, because the water makes the fibers soft and fares up the lay. So bends, hitches, and knots tighten up when they get wet. So much so that there are some we can't use at sea because they get so damn tight that you can't untie them. And that can condemn a poor soul to a nasty death in the wrong circumstances. I once seen a boy about Willie's age get his throat crushed when he couldn't loosen the knot around his neck that held him to the mast to keep him from washing overboard in a storm.
Heron pulled the soaked rope from the bucket and handed it to Kahale.
"Untie that," he instructed.
The missionary tugged and struggled, but he could not undo Heron's knot. He grinned sheepishly and handed it back.
"Two masts and dozens of knots, bends, and hitches," said Heron. "We check every one of 'em every day, sometimes twice. Look there."
He pointed to Bembe, who was wrapping a length of rope around the base of the mainmast.
"You must master knots and hitches before you can learn how to rig. And boys, solid rigging is the soul of every ship that raises sail. By the time I was 12, I knew how to fully rig a ship, from the bowsprit to the lower mast, topmast, jig boom, and whiskers, every part of every sail. Most important thing I ever learned. Well, maybe except how to properly stroke the withers of a pink-cheeked lassie, so she'd happily unloose the doors of her sweet little treasure chest."
Heron laughed at his own joke and ignored the flushed expression on Kahale's face.
"Let's to it. Now," Heron said, "first the reef knot, then the bowline, the figure eight, and then the constrictor. I'll show you the proper way of tying each, and then you'll practice till your hands are blistered and your knots are perfect."
Heron took them through the paces for their first four knots and then left them to tend to the sail. McNab was at the tiller, and Jacob, the cook, came up on deck to peel potatoes in the fresh air, while Boswell jotted notes in his journal in the shade of a stack of barrels lashed to the deck. An hour later, Bembe stepped away from his sail and joined Thomas and Edward to check on their progress. The tropical sun was high overhead, and when the Jamaican peeled off his linen shirt to get some relief, Thomas gasped. The black man's back was a mass of thick burn scars from the base of his neck to his waistline. Thomas had witnessed the effects of burns many times during the war, but Bembe's wounds were the worst he had seen. Bembe felt his stare, but only smiled.
"Burned by the water,"
he said in a thick accent as he tied a constrictor knot and handed it to Kahale to try again.
"Water?" the missionary asked. "How's that possible?"
"I worked two kinds of cargo out of Maine before I tossed my sea bag on Captain McNab's deck. The first was river ice out of the Kennebec above Bath. We hauled ice to Baltimore and all over the Caribbean and South America. Hell, our ice was so pure and beautiful that some schooners carried it all the way to Calcutta, India. I came out here in 70, and the year before, over 500,000 tons of ice were transported around the world by schooner."
"So you were burned by ice?" Thomas asked.
"No," laughed Bembe. "By slack lime. That was the other cargo I worked. Lime has to be burned in giant kilns for days before it can take on a form that can be mixed into mortar or plaster. And the burning causes it to change chemically. Problem is, when slack lime comes in contact with seawater, it ignites."
Kahale and Thomas shook their heads in disbelief, and Thomas spoke for them both when he said,
"Then why the hell did they transport it on schooners?"
"The sea is the only road that circles the world," replied Bembe with a shrug. "Shipbuilders used extra thick planking in the hulls of ships that carry slack lime, and we did everything to keep it dry when we were at sea, but in a storm sometimes it just was impossible. One way or another, some water would leak through the seams, and a burn would begin. Sometimes the fire burned so hot the schooner had to be scuttled. My fire happened off the coast of Georgia. I was lucky. Five of my shipmates were roasted alive below decks."
Thomas grimaced inwardly at the thought of such a fire, but before he could reply, Willie raced over from the starboard side, ducked under a sail, and plopped a wooden bucket on the deck between him and Kahale. There were 6 or 7 brightly colored fish in the bucket, each about 1 foot long.
"A whole school of them," gushed the boy. "Best fishing day for me ever!"
Boswell set down his sketch pad and pencil and joined the group gathered around the bucket. He lifted out one of the iridescent fish and inspected it carefully.
"Parrotfish, or Cetosaurus bicolor," he said, "first described by Ruppel in 1829, I believe. They are extraordinary creatures, sequential hermaphrodites, actually. They begin life as females and then change to males. Their coloring changes, too."
He turned the fish over several times and then asked Willie if he could keep it to sketch and dissect. That's when Jacob appeared with the basket in hand.
"Male or female's no concern to me, Mr. Boswell," said the cook. "Parrotfish are prime eatin', and as long as there are enough for dinner, ye are welcome to keep one for a pet."
The leathery old man wiped his hands on his apron, winked at Thomas, and then turned to Willie.
"They taste better raw, laddie. Did you know that?"
The boy blanched at the thought.
"Marinated in lime juice and coconut milk,"
the ship's cook continued.
"It's called poisson cru à la Tahitienne."
"And it's damn tasty," said Captain McNabb, who had just handed the helm over to Heron. "But like Willie, I believe we should prepare this batch with a little lemon and butter and break out some of that dry chablis Jacob's been hoarding."
Jacob waved his hand in the air at the mild reproach and shuffled off to prepare the feast. McNabb sat down with Edward and Thomas and watched as they tied each of the 4 knots they had been working on all day, while Boswell pulled his colored charcoal from a canvas pouch and began to sketch the parrotfish. When Thomas tied the final bowline knot to the captain's satisfaction, his hands were a bit blistered and his fingers ached, but he felt a sense of achievement that he had not experienced in months. He looked up into the full sails, felt the sweet sea mist on his face, and listened to the music of the bow slicing through the turquoise sea. Tonight, he and his shipmates would have a fine dinner with an excellent French chablis, followed by cigars, brandy, and storytelling on deck under a glittering carpet of equatorial stars. He smiled. "I could get used to this," he thought.